Welcome to the Empirical Cycling Podcast. I'm your host, Coley Moore. Thanks, everybody, for listening, as always. And, of course, please subscribe to the podcast, but mostly share the podcast, especially if it's helping you out. It's going to help out other folks, too. Guarantee that. So if you want to give us a great rating wherever you listen to podcasts and iTunes, thank you so much for all of those. If you want to donate to the podcast, that's how we keep the lights on. And you can do so at empiricalcycling.com/donate. Thank you all for your donations so far. It really helps us out. And of course, if you want to help the show by becoming an empirical cycling athlete or hiring us for consultation, you can definitely do that too and reach out to me directly at empiricalcycling@gmail.com. We have show notes up on the website. I'm actually going to go try to dig up the references for the papers that we referenced. I know of at least one offhand, but we're probably going to get more. And of course, we have a bunch of questions from the Instagram. So if you want to ask a question for future podcasts, we're going to do that from now on before we record. You can go follow me at Empirical Cycling on Instagram. And so thanks all for that. And so today, this is a really exciting podcast because this is one of the biggest topics everybody's been asking for is nutrition. And so we have Namrita Brooke on the show, and she is the nutritionist I refer everyone to. She is fantastic. You're going to see why we get along in a little bit. You're going to see why I refer people to her. And so this is a great wide-ranging episode. Nominally, we started out, we wanted to talk about what should you eat on the bike and why and how much, et cetera, et cetera. We do get to all that, but we get to so much more. We get to things like the context of the ride in the day and how then you cannot really separate the nutrition on the ride from what you're doing in the rest of the day. We talk about glucose and fructose ratios. We talk about solid versus liquid foods. We talk about different products, and we talk about, you know, fueling with hydration and all that kind of stuff. So we get to a lot of really good stuff. And so I hope everybody enjoys the podcast as much as I enjoyed recording it. Talking to Namrita is always a real pleasure. And so we're definitely going to be doing more of these in the future. And so without further ado, let's get to the interview, and I'll see you on the other side, of course, with some contact info. What was it you just said about there's a lot of experts?
Yeah, the because everyone eats, so they, for some reason, feel like, you know, they can give nutrition advice based on what works for them. So we were just talking about how many questions you got on Instagram and how everyone just, you know, always has nutrition questions. You can kind of figure out training. But, yeah, I mean, I just find it funny that there's still so much confusion out there. And I think it's all these armchair experts that lead to that confusion. It's like, you know, there's... everyone has a different opinion on what works for them, or sometimes works for them. And then you try it and you're like, nope, that doesn't work. Now what? Like, someone else says the exact opposite thing. Try that. Okay, that doesn't work. Yeah, so that's, I see that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I just had one of those debates recently, like last weekend. I was like, if I have a swig of Gatorade, like straight Gatorade mid-ride, like my guts turn into a knot for like an hour. And other people were like, I don't have that problem. So actually, that, why is it that some people like react strongly to Gatorade and some people don't? Is it the osmolarity? Is it the concentration?
Yeah, yeah. So that's kind of the biggest thing. I mean, Gatorade is simple sugars, and so it doesn't have, you know, I mean, I guess technically it has sucrose, so it has glucose and fructose, but... The osmolality of that, you know, is the more particles in a solution, the more concentrated it is, right? And so if you're drinking too much of it, or if you're drinking a little bit in combination with gels or something else that's a higher carbohydrate concentration, then what's going to happen is your body has to pull water into the gut to kind of dilute that out to allow it to actually transport across your gut. So... yeah, I mean, I think everyone's threshold for that is probably a little bit different. And that's the other interesting thing about nutrition is it is so individual because everyone's system inside is a little bit different. And that could be based on genetics. It could be based on diet. It could be based on training and fitness status, you know, how long you've been riding and how many have you always been used to taking in a high amount of carbohydrates and Gatorade, so maybe you're better at transporting that. Or maybe you drank a bunch of water before. If you're a little bit dehydrated, it does make stuff worse. So that's also pretty common for why you might react to something that's like simple sugars like that.
Yeah, well, that kind of sounds like that training the gut thing, which is, mm-hmm. I've always wondered, is that a real thing? Like, and what is the mechanism behind it? I'm wondering if it's like blood flow to the intestines, because the intestines, when mm-hmm. we are eating, require a huge amount of blood, and that can take it away from the legs, right?
Sure, exactly. So part of training the gut, it's actually, there's a few things going on. One, if you are generally already eating a fairly high carbohydrate diet, and by that I would say, you know, generally around like 8 grams of carbs per kilogram per day is about, you know, on the high end of average to low end of high, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So if you're already eating like that, you're used to taking in exogenous carbs or taking in carbohydrates during your training, your gut transporters for, you know, the glucose and the other carbohydrates is pretty good. Like, they're there and they're used to working. You know, when you don't use the machinery in your body, it kind of goes to sleep, right? It doesn't, they mm-hmm. downregulate, they go away. But if you are already used to that, so someone who's been training for a very long time with high carbohydrates, eats a generally high carb diet, they don't need to really train their gut. They're already used to that. But the other part of training the gut is also being able to handle the volume. So gastric emptying is really important. So the nutrients and the fluid has to go through your stomach before it empties into your small intestine, where the absorption takes place. So if it's taking a long time to get through your stomach, or it's really uncomfortable, like your stomach feels bloated because you're not used to the volume and the rate of intake, that makes everything worse. So you want to, that is trainable too. So training your gastric emptying by just like eating bigger meals before training, drinking higher amounts of, or higher rates of fluid during training. So all of that is part of training the gut. And it's uncomfortable. I mean, people are like, well, I don't ever eat, or I take in, you know, I might take in like a bar or something for a 2-hour ride, or, you know, if it's a ride over 2 or 2.5 hours, I'll grab a gel. I'm like, okay, so yes, you're far off the recommendations, which, you know, maybe a common one is like 60 to 90 grams of carbs an hour, and maybe like 24 ounces of fluid an hour or something. Mm-hmm. So if you're not anywhere near that, it doesn't make sense for you to just jump into that, or like, oh, I heard 120 grams of carbs per hour is where it's at. That's what all the pros are doing. But if you try to do that, you're going to end up in trouble because you haven't trained your stomach to be able to handle that rate of intake. You haven't trained your intestines and your transporters. So stuff is just going to kind of like hang out there, and it's going to be uncomfortable. You're going to feel bloated. You can have all sorts of GI issues, really. But so then when they start, they're like, okay, well, I'll train the gut. So I'll do that with training. But you still have to do that somewhat gradually if you're new to this. And at some point, it's going to be uncomfortable. So training after a big meal, it's not as bad for cyclists as it is for runners.
That's for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, it just depends really on you and your history and what your other, you know, what your regular diet is like too. If you're just, you kind of eat like little bits here and there and like graze all day, it's going to be harder to have a giant breakfast with 200 grams of carbs and then, you know, a bunch of fluid, get on the bike, and then trying to start, you know, hitting the general recommendations that are out there.
Well, and so when it comes to gut training, I mean, how much of it is like, just what you eat? Because I imagine if you have like 5 Nutri-Grain bars, that's a lot different than having like a bunch of apples or potatoes or something like that. Because when it comes to things like gastric emptying, so we're talking about, you know, how like food sitting inside the gut, what affects the gastric emptying rate aside from just kind of getting used to the higher volume of food? Because off the top of my head, I can think of temperature and mm-hmm. water content, right?
Yeah, for sure. So the volume of fluid is one thing. So the higher amount or the higher bolus of fluid you're taking in, theoretically, if you're used to it, it should speed up gastric emptying. So it'll move through faster.
And can you use this to help food move through? Because I'm not sure entirely, because this is not my area of expertise, and that's why you're here. But Isn't it like fluid and solid food move through the, have a different gastric emptying rate, even if they're in there at the same time?
Yeah, right. So, well...
Okay, so we just made all this really complicated. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm thinking back. But in general, like fat and fiber will slow down the rate of gastric emptying. So we have, you know, enzymes that start breaking down food in your mouth with your saliva and then like all through your GI tract. So depending, like the more simple the food is before you eat it, the faster that's going to start breaking down. You've also got mechanical digestion and like processing with chewing. So, but yeah, I mean, in general, the heavier the food, so the more fat, I would say, the more fiber. And to be honest, I don't know. I guess the protein, like if you're eating protein, it would depend on other things like the fat and fiber too. But I don't know what like the gastric emptying rate of a chicken breast would be. I don't know. Like I wouldn't suggest you eat that anyway. So I guess it's sort of irrelevant right now. But yeah, so if you're eating food, like if you're eating a bar or a gel or whatever, like drinking water with that, a higher volume can help move all of it through. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you think of like the mechanical digestion, the chemical breakdown that happens in your stomach with all the churning and stuff. It does sort of turn into like a mush, I guess, or like, you know, liquidy, semi-solid. So it'll move through faster with the larger volume. But what else affects it? So yeah, that's interesting. Heat, which is relevant right now. It's getting hot. So if heat is a factor in your environment, then, you know, that could slow down gastric emptying, but hopefully you're also increasing your fluid intake to kind of counteract that. Exercise intensity. So you may find that it's easier to tolerate food, drink, or even like a higher rate at a lower intensity. But when stuff gets hard, we don't have the same blood flow to the gut as you alluded to before. So that kind of also impedes gastric emptying. Mm-hmm. So those are the main factors. Yeah.
Okay. So let's, that was all kind of like heady, like more advanced stuff. But I was kind of fascinated to kind of chase that rabbit hole down, but, why don't we get into something a little more simple? Because we can kind of build on all that stuff and also get into a couple different avenues for all this stuff. So when it comes to eating on the bike, generally speaking, all carbs, at what point do you want to add more than just carbohydrates? Like what time would you want to add a little bit of protein and possibly a little bit of fat, even though, you know, a couple grams of fat is basically impossible to avoid at some point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A longer ride. So for some people, generally speaking, if you're competing, let's just look at a race scenario. I would say carbs only up until like maybe a 4 or 6 hour race. Mm-hmm. And then anything for that length or longer, you can start adding in a little bit of real food, whether that's bars or a sandwich or, you know, kind of whatever, again, you're able to tolerate. Still, the majority of the intake should be carbs, but it's more like some people start to feel hungry or all the carbs start to just, you know, they feel kind of empty inside. And so that's also pretty individual. Do you need the fat and the protein? I would say no. We have plenty of it in our bodies, you know, that we use for oxidation, at least for fat. And as far as protein, if in general you are meeting your protein needs, you will have sufficient branched chain amino acids to oxidize, which are really the only ones that are oxidized for energy purposefully while you're training or racing. But also, if your carbohydrate intake is adequate, you're not going to need to break down additional protein to make glucose.
Mm-hmm. So like what would the gut feeling be like? How would you describe it? If somebody's like, man, I'm eating carbs for like my 4 hour race, but I just don't feel good. And I still feel even a little hungry, or like I'm getting that, like that gut kind of.
Yeah. So I would describe it more of like a hungry, empty feeling. And if your race is only 4 hours, like if you start to feel like that around 3.5 hours, you're, I think you can push through, because like if you tell yourself, I don't need that, but you know, I'm looking forward to eating a huge meal afterwards, make sure you're eating enough before your ride too. So, you know, I think a super common mistake for a lot of athletes is they're so focused on like super specific to the gram and like, you know, do I need to take branched chain amino acids in during my ride because it's over 4 hours long? But what are you doing? What are you eating before your ride? That's really important. So if you are one of those riders that ends up feeling hungry, but you know, it's fine to take stuff in on a training ride, but I'm talking about a race specifically when performance is the goal, the carbs are what is going to fuel that effort and intensity. If you tend to get hungry towards the end of a longer ride or race, eat a big breakfast and eat something that'll stick with you a little bit longer. And then again, honestly, it's not that big a deal to have an energy bar in there. Something that's mostly carbs with a little bit of fat and protein isn't going to disrupt a whole lot. Now, when you're going out for 100-mile races, longer, if you're doing bikepacking stuff, yeah, you're going to want some real food. I mean, one, you're not going to meet your overall energy needs in that day with just taking in even 100 grams of carbs per hour. You're not going to meet your protein needs. And you're going to feel hungry. You're going to want some regular food. So whether that's, you know, stopping at a gas station or a fast food restaurant or whatever is on your route, it's fine. You just have to make sure that you've also trained like that.
Right. And that's one of the things that we work with specifically with ultra people is, you know, getting the nutrition strategy dialed in and practicing it, because otherwise, like, you get to race day, it's like, oh no, I'm in the middle of nowhere and there's only a gas station. What do I get? You know?
Yeah. That's a common problem. I guess the other common problem is, I don't really love gels, or I trained so much with these gels and now I don't want to use that flavor, so I'm going to try something else. Or I got this from my sponsor, or I got this free in my race bag, but you've never tried it. Like, don't do that.
Yeah.
And then if you know that it's a self-supported ride or race and you physically just can't carry everything you need, figure out what's on the route. Where are you going to stop? Is it gas stations? What time are restaurants open and closed? Like, what's available? And then train with that too.
Yeah. And so when it comes to how much to eat, now this is a really big question for a lot of folks, because pretty much universally, the guidance that I usually give my athletes is more, because whenever I ask them how much did you eat on this ride, it's never enough. And this goes for, you know, athletes of all levels, including races too. So kind of two things around this. So, my first question is kind of academic, but kind of not, is why is it that 100 to 120 grams an hour is pretty much universal? Like, why don't we control for the size of the person, like as an upper limit for carb intake recommendation?
Yeah, it's super interesting. I mean, I always wondered that too. But it turns out that it's the capability of the individual and the athlete to... We can measure in the intake rate, right? So we know, we don't know exactly how much muscle glycogen you have, so the stored carbohydrate, but we can obviously measure the exogenous, so what you're taking in during. And so we can also measure, you know, with labeling the carbons, we can label the exhaled CO2, and we can figure out what the oxidation rate is. So what is the actual utilization rate of compared to what's been taken in. And I think it really has to do more with training status. So how long have you been training? I'm sure, you know, somewhat genetic too, but, you know what? So one, are you able to get the carbs from your gut into your bloodstream? Then are you able to get the carbs from your bloodstream into your muscle? That's another transport mechanism. And then are you able to actually utilize those specific carbs that you took in through your mouth, you know, to produce ATP? And then we can measure that by the expired CO2. So there's no gender and body size are not a factor in that. It's pretty much, I would say, training status and then also exercise intensity. But actually, an interesting paper, I just read it recently, it just came out looking at types of, like, different modes of carbohydrate. So gels, chews, I think bars and sports drinks.
Yeah, they were it was all identical, right? The results.
Yeah. And but they were, again, trained elite, you know, male cyclists. They probably have been training with high carbohydrate for a long time. They ate a high carb diet before. So all of the, like, internal machinery is there and working. And they found a pretty high carbohydrate oxidation rate. I can't remember exactly, but it was like, it was pretty high. It was higher than what's normally reported in the literature. So they were able to use it. Now, there was another paper, and I'm, like, totally blanking on who wrote it, but or who published it, but it was less elite. I think it was ultra runners, and they gave them 90 or above grams of carbs per hour, and their oxidation rates were much lower. So they're saying, okay, well, perhaps it's because they're not as well trained. Perhaps it has to do with running versus cycling. But whatever that is, it's not like they have to take in 90 to 120 grams of carbs per hour because they're not actually utilizing it. They're not oxidizing it to the same rate as, you know, an elite male cyclist would.
Well, that would be a difference of also power output and, like, energy demand as well.
Exactly,
right?
For sure. Yeah.
Okay, so how would your nutrition recommendations for a race, so like stage one of Tour of the Gila is today, and so for a 50-kilogram woman doing that race versus a, let's say, 100-kilogram man, so how would your recommendation change for them? Because we're going to be looking at a difference between an FTP of, like, probably 230 to 250 versus an FTP of, like, well over 400.
Right. So the main thing is general carb recommendations or general macronutrient recommendations are always based on body weight, so by the kilogram. So in general, the female athlete would have a lower absolute carbohydrate intake, assuming we were doing, like, let's say 10 grams per kilogram per day. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the male who weighs twice as much, but maybe his goals aren't the same, maybe he's not racing at the front, maybe he's just doing a race to finish, which probably not in this case, but you know, his general intake might be lower. So yeah, like the smaller female cyclist who has a very high training load, training, you know, volume, everything, we may be giving her 10 to 12 grams of carbs per kilogram per day, where the man were giving, you know, 8 to 10. So that's the first thing. Like, that's when I really consider body weight, is for general recommendations. And then when you go to the race itself, you also look at, okay, what are the goals? Are you doing the race to finish? Have you trained with 120 grams per hour? Those are all factors I think about. But if everything's the same, then I wouldn't change the recommendation based on body weight. I would say, okay, both of you, for a stage race like this, you know, you want to take in as much as you can, presuming you've trained with it. We know you can utilize it. It helps your performance. You get a head start on recovery, and you're not starting the subsequent stage in a depleted state whatsoever.
So that would be, you know, pretty much like, you know, like 80 to 120 grams an hour, or like whatever you can get in.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting you say getting a head start on the recovery, because this is something that I think I've tried to impress upon people as well. And some of them don't really buy it. you know, you have an actual PhD in this. So I want you to tell people why it gives them a head start on the recovery.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really understand why you would think that it doesn't, because your ride is just a part of your whole day, which is a part of your whole week. It's not this, like, isolated, you know, your body is the system, and this is one thing you're doing the whole day. So, yeah, everything you can get in before, during, and after really impacts everything else. And especially in stage racing, it's crucial. You know, if you have, if you're at the end of like a 3-week training block and you have a recovery week, you're not going to do anything. Okay. It's not super imperative. I'm not going to lie. You don't have to like rush, you know, rush yeah. home to like, to eat a bunch of food and then like, you know, eat every 2 hours. But if you're doing a stage race, it sure is really important. And I would say definitely a key factor for performance in stage racing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so what's happening is, you know, you have muscle that can store carbohydrate. You have your liver that can store carbohydrate. We can store a lot of fat. It's, I don't know how much, but it depends, obviously.
It's something on your size. like 30 to 50,000 kilojoules or something like that, yeah, for an average athlete. Yeah, it's a ton.
But yeah, so like carbohydrate is, we know, I mean, you can have your opinions, but we know that carbohydrate is related to performance. Directly. So why, you know, if we're limited in how much we can take in per hour based on whatever, you know, mechanisms that limit carbohydrate oxidation, why would we want to also limit or compromise our endogenous or internal carbohydrate stores in our liver or our muscle? Now, it takes a while if you completely deplete them. So if you, you know, start fasted or with a small breakfast, you go out on a long ride, you're taking in, you know, 100 calories an hour, which is not enough. And then you're like kind of lax about your recovery regimen. It's no surprise that you're going to feel not as strong the next day. You're probably not going to feel great for the rest of the day. Hopefully you don't have to go to work or anything or like deal with people, but it's, yeah. So constantly making sure that you're staying on top of those glycogen stores is really key. Your whole body uses glucose, your nervous system, you know, your brain, everything, every cell uses glucose. So I think people forget about that. They're like, oh, well, I'm looking at, you know, kilojoules expended on my training ride. I want to go like eat a huge pizza later. Like I'm not worried about, they're just thinking like calories sometimes, I think, or they're thinking I need to lose a few pounds, or I'm not really sure, to be honest. I think it's different based on like what drives you, right? And what your hangups are.
And I have sure encountered all of those situations in the people I coach and the people you coach. I'm sure you've encountered pretty much the same things too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because I think what I'm hearing here too, that I think is really interesting, is that part of what your considerations are is the whole day's energy balance. Like the ride is kind of inextricable from what you're eating on and off the bike. And actually this is something that has always fascinated me with like ultra endurance is, you know, you're exercising all day. And so you still have to meet your normal energy needs. And so if you're going to ride for like 12 to 24 hours, like, you know, you can't just like eat carbs all day, like you said. And so I think that's a fascinating part of this whole thing. Cause like, you know, for a stage race like Hilo right now, you know, if somebody's not eating well enough on day one, it's going to put them on the back foot for day two, and they're really going to be suffering for that last stage.
That's right. And honestly, there's no good way to come back from that. So, like, my advice is just don't put yourself in that position. Yeah, stuff happens, but there's only so much you can do to try to recover from that. And, again, because we can't just measure our internal glycogen stores, we don't really know. But if you're really depleted, I mean, and you underfuel for whatever reason, I would say really try to make sure that the rest of the day you're getting in like 12 grams per kilogram of your body weight of carbs. Like you could, it's a lot. And especially like with a long stage, you don't have a lot of time left after that, but do your best because you pretty much can't eat enough at that point. And who knows how much of it's going to make it in, right? To your muscle. We don't know that.
Let's call it a dire situation would be like 10 to 15% of glycogen stores left. But like, let's call it like even a 30, you've got 30% of your glycogen stores left in your legs and, you know, whatever, wherever else in your body, liver, nervous system, et cetera, et cetera. So like, the rate of, my impression is, and I think you'll probably confirm me on this, the rate of glycogen repletion is not, you don't get back to 100% the next day. Like, it'll probably take 2 to 3 or even 4 days to really get there if you're super depleted, right?
Yeah. So, right. And so, for example, if you're considering like a pre-race carbohydrate loading protocol, if you were for some reason following a low carb diet and then wanting to carb load before, I would say 10 to 12 grams of carbs per kg per day for 3 to 5 days leading up to the race. But again, if you are normally eating a generally carb adequate diet, 8 to 10 grams of carbs per kg per day, you already have somewhat fuller glycogen stores. Again, I have no idea, like it just depends on so many factors, but you don't have to carb load for as long, right? Because the rate is all the enzymes, and again, the internal machinery, there's all these rate limiting steps. So you can't just like eat, you know, drink a bunch of fruit juice and eat loaves of bread and assume it's all going to go in and work for you the next day. So yeah, I mean, just don't try to not get yourself in that situation. Take the recovery as serious as you're taking the stage in the racing. And because, yeah, I mean, that's just wasting so much good training if you're not.
That's wasting good training. That is a really good way to think about
it. Sad. I feel for people who just mess up their nutrition because they were trying to like not eat too many calories the week before the race because their training was low, or they don't subscribe to like, they're like, oh, I don't need, you know, I'm a really good fat burner, so I don't need that many carbs. And then you see them just like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even at relatively low intensities, like the amount of carbohydrates that get used is, it's kind of surprising.
Right. Exactly. Talk about like common, we could do a whole podcast on common misconceptions, but,
oh, we will.
Yeah. It's, you know, there's no on off switch. You're always burning some carbs, and,
that's why there's always lactate in the blood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Actually, that reminds me a little bit before I get to my next actual question. I remember I was coaching somebody through a stage race in Europe, and I remember them saying that, like, oh my God, I'm eating so much more than my teammates, and I feel weird about this. And I was like, well, how much are you eating? And they told me, and I was like, I think you're doing the right thing. And they actually had a great performance for that race. So, like, I think one of the things that scares a lot of people, especially for races with climbing, is the body weight. And so the water weight associated with glycogen is one of those things that seems to scare a lot of cyclists, especially with like carb loading, because you might gain like a kilo or more 3 or 4 days like leading up to a race while you're carb loading. But that's like good weight to have, isn't it?
Yeah, that's one of those things that like is hard to convince someone until they've made the mistake, and then they're like, okay, it's better to, and I think there's been studies done on this too, I'm pretty sure. I can't think of exactly which ones right now, but yeah, like the weight, it's not really a penalty because it's going to serve you very well. If you're starting dehydrated or underfueled, your performance is going to be far worse than if you're carrying a little bit of extra weight, which is going to burn off quickly anyway. You just have to be okay with that, like, kind of, like, uncomfortable feeling, you know, leading into it. But that's, I mean, elite marathoners, elite, you know, bike racers, they're used to that. And so the more you do that, the more it just becomes part of, like, not messing with your head on race day, and it just becomes part of your, like, performance, you know, mindset, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I remember listening to a bodybuilder talking about bulking and cutting phases and just the water weight, you know, at 250 pounds, like the water weight fluctuations of like, you know, 5 to 10 pounds or more sometimes it's incredible, especially, you know, coming out after a show. But like, I think last time I talked to Andy Galpin, he mentioned that I forget if he was involved in this study, but he said that there's a study on cross-country runners, I think it was high school or college, and during their taper, their type 1 fibers actually hypertrophied. Like, they got larger, which they did with a biopsy and then looked at the cross-section. And that was because they were actually gaining muscle glycogen, and associated water. Mm-hmm. And so the cells are actually just swelling.
Right.
So fascinating.
Yeah. That's, and I've heard of like bodybuilding coaches talk about that too. You know, it's when you have that, it actually makes your muscles look bigger. So it's, you know, for fitness competitions and whatever, like, so it's actually a good thing. But yeah, I mean, I get it for a cyclist, especially in a climbing race or in, you know, a running race where you, the common like thought is I want to be as light as possible. It's hard to swallow that, but once you figure out that, you know, your performance is directly related to that, or could be worse if you didn't do that, then it just kind of makes sense and you just deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I've worked with those athletes, and I'm sure you have too, where, you know, they're getting lighter and they're like, yay, this is great. But the power output's dropping. And it's mm-hmm. like the power output's dropping more than the weight they're losing in terms of watts per kilo. And it's like, you were actually a better climber when you were heavier.
That's true. That, and it's so good to have a coach, you know, like you to point that out, because there's so many that aren't. And, yeah, it's unfortunate, but I know, because I work with some of your athletes, and I really appreciate that insight from you. And like, you know, you're a data person too, and you're a reasonable guy. You understand performance, and you understand all these things. So it really matters, especially with something like that. It's so mental for an athlete. Like if they're constantly thinking they're too heavy, that's just not good.
Yeah. Well, and you understand the same things too. And I remember like when I was looking for a nutritionist to recommend to people, and you're the person I recommend everyone to the point where I'm sure you're probably way too busy at this point. I'm not sorry about that, by the way. But like, you know, it became apparent you had kind of the same overall driving philosophy of performance and just, you know, no fat diets, like all science based. Actually, that reminds me, I've always wanted to ask you, I was going to look this up, but I'd rather just ask you on the podcast. What was your PhD on?
Yeah. So, I looked at, carbohydrate and caffeine and the effects on mental and physical fatigue. And then I compared, trained athletes with untrained. So just like healthy recreational college students. Mm-hmm. So partially exercise phys, partially nutrition, partially cognition and in the brain. So really interested in how that all works together. And I think that's also why I really enjoy, you know, a lot of your content, because RPE for me and like the brain and the brain's involvement in decision making and pacing and all this stuff, including appetite and, you know, what drives performance factors is so important. Like data is great, but using it with RPE and being in touch with hunger and thirst and, you know, sodium appetite, for example, I know you've heard me talk about that. Like mm-hmm. we can't just blindly follow guidelines and look at numbers. We have to, our brain is the most powerful controller in the body. So when it comes to performance, like if you're not listening to that, then I think you're selling yourself short. Yeah.
I think that's I was thinking like, that's a great insight, but it also shouldn't be an insight so much, should it?
I know, right? Yeah. I think that's why your RPE meme was so great.
Thank you.
It's like, I'm not really a meme person like you, but I was like, this is the best. I love it.
I'm not a meme person either, but I made one and people liked it, and I made another and people liked it, and people were like, do more. And I'm like, all right. And you know, just secretly just between you and me and the like 10 people who are going to listen to this podcast, you know, it's actually great to like get people to follow my Instagram page, and that gets people to listen to the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the nice things about it. But also I hope to try to like impart a little bit of wisdom with the memes too. Mm-hmm. Even though every time I post one, somebody's like, well, that's not how it actually works. It's like, I know it's a joke. Actually, I want to ask you one thing about your PhD, because, you know, you had said, I hope I don't have to crack out my biochem textbook for this podcast. Yeah.
No, this was like so long ago. Okay.
Yeah. But, what is, like, how does caffeine affect carbohydrate utilization? Because if I'm not mistaken, it's been a while since I've thought about this too, it basically creates cyclic AMP, which creates blah, 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 which increases like cortisol and catecholamines in the body or something like that. And it increases glucose utilization at rest, right? But does it affect it at performance? That's just by memory. It's been a while.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't remember that. I think there's probably studies that say it does increase carbohydrate oxidation. Again, I think there's so many other factors that could, you know, lead to that conclusion. I don't remember that I saw any difference in carbohydrate oxidation between carbohydrate and caffeine versus carbohydrate alone.
Interesting. Okay.
But it also could have been dependent on the exercise intensity we were using. Again, other factors. But it did influence fatigue or time to fatigue. It also improved mental performance on a cognitive test following physical fatigue.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I mean...
Well, did it improve or decrease time to fatigue? I would think it would improve, right?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, Yeah. Okay, right. Yeah, I just wanted to double check.
Yeah, so increased the time till before someone was fatigued. And then we had them, like, hop on a computer and do a cognitive performance test. And during the caffeine plus carb trials, they actually did better than the carbohydrate alone, which not super surprising. But, yeah, there. If you're a caffeine responder, you know, there's definitely people who don't use it, and you've probably figured out by now if you're a responder or not. Everyone I had, and I don't know what the percentages of, you know, non-caffeine responders or people who it makes them feel worse, like jittery or perform worse.
I would say, but, oh, that's like a super responder.
Yeah, right. Well, if you feel jittery, but if you're not... if you feel like it negatively impacts your performance, then obviously, you know, don't use it. But everyone I had in my study, which I think I had 24 subjects, I mean, everyone was a caffeine responder, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, well, it sounds like almost like a responder is somebody where, like, it overclocks your computer a little bit and performance improves and, you know, it generates a little more heat, but it's fine. But, like, a non-responder is somebody where, like, it way overclocks and you don't get that extra performance or something. That's what it sounds like, right? Am I right or am I I'm probably wrong on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, yes. No, I had an athlete I worked with. She would eat a caffeinated gel, which, you know, some of them are like 25 to 50 milligrams. She's like, I can't do it.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's people who, again, you've probably figured it out by now. If you've tried coffee because you've heard, you know, coffee and cycling, coffee and science, coffee and everything, like, goes together, coffee and functioning. And you're like, but it doesn't do that for me, so I don't drink it. Yeah. So I wouldn't try caffeinated, like, caffeine before an event or during. Just, yeah, I mean, it's fine. You know, there's other things you can do. It is, if you're a responder, if it works for you, it's a wonderful ergogenic aid. But if it doesn't work for you, then there's no point in trying it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for some people, it's just an aid to just wake up and get through the day. And I may or may not be on my, like, sixth cup of coffee today. So I'm going to abstain from judgment from anybody, no matter how much you do or don't drink. Right. Okay. So training rides, a little different than a race, right? So, like, like an endurance ride, you know, is there a general recommendation for an endurance ride? And, like, does it change once you get to, like, a certain power output? So let's say, you know, let's say I'm going to go out and do an endurance ride, and I've barely ridden my bike in a little bit. So I'm going to do it at, like, 100 watts. So I'm not really going to burn that many kilojoules. Let's say one of my pros goes out and he'll do, like, 250 watts or more for an endurance ride. So he's burning a ton of kilojoules. So, like, is there functionally a difference in that kind of thing for a nutrition recommendation, or is it pretty much going to be about the same?
Okay. I kind of, like, got a little bit lost in the example, but...
Oh, sorry.
No, it's okay. So, I mean, if you're super untrained and 100 watts is what percent of your FTP, like...
I don't know, like 50.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're burning some carbs. Again, you're burning fat. Again, I'm going to go to what did you eat before the ride? What is your purpose? What are you doing the day after? Are you trying to do another endurance ride? Are you trying to do, you know, tempo workout or what? Like, so do you need full glycogen stores? If you eat breakfast before your ride at 100 watts, I think you can get away with, you know, depending on how long the ride is, if it's longer than 90 minutes, you know, maybe 30 grams of carbs per hour or something. Mm-hmm. Because you don't, like, there's no point in just completely depleting everything.
Right.
You're not going to take in, you know, the exact amount that you're expending anyway. So you're still going to be in a deficit. But why? You don't need to be fasted, I guess, if that's your question. However, is it going to hurt you? Well, if you're going to hop on your bike like once and it's been a while and then you're not probably going to ride again for a couple weeks, it probably doesn't matter. You can just eat breakfast, go ride, you know, ride super easy and then have a meal afterwards.
That is pretty much what I do, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is fine. But if you're trying to do something bigger the next day, or you're trying to build, right? If you're now following a training plan and each ride builds upon the next, you're going to want more. So for an endurance ride, again, because you're still burning a good amount of fat, you know, your energy needs are lower than if you're working harder. Mm-hmm. So overall, your percentage of fat oxidized from your body will be higher. Your carbohydrate needs are lower. So, you know, still, I would say 30 to 60 grams of carbs per hour is probably fine, even for someone really well trained who's just doing, you know, a ride at 50% of max or 50% of FTP. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was your example. But if that same rider the next day has a hard workout or a race, then I would say be on the upper end of that, so 60 grams of carbs per hour, and then make sure that you're going home and getting right on your recovery. So your post-ride recovery meal, and you're already thinking about the next day. It's not different from a stage race where you're fueling for the current day and the next day. So yeah, it's always like my answer should just always be, it depends.
True scientist. Well, I think it's fascinating because that's a perspective that I have not heard that much. And actually I haven't really considered that much myself. I mean, like if you asked me academically, I would say, yeah, of course it depends what are you doing the next day. But like, generally speaking, it's not something that I usually consider when it comes to how much you should eat on a ride. And I think that's something that a lot of folks probably don't consider as well, is what am I doing tomorrow and the next day and the next day? And you know, at what rate approximately does it take me to fully recover my glycogen stores and just generally from the ride? And what do I have coming up? So, so it's interesting to like, cause you know, half of me was like, maybe we can come away with some recommendations just in a vacuum. But also at the same time, it's like you can't really do that and have a really good nutrition plan or training plan at all.
Yeah. So here's maybe a good takeaway, which is, it's not really a recommendation. It's more of just a takeaway. But do you have a performance mindset, or do you just have, you know, I'm cycling, I'm doing this to burn calories and eat a lot of food after. So like if your mindset is, I'm not on a training plan, I'm not doing anything to train for performance, I'm fine just like tooling around and riding. I mean, you probably don't have a coach at this point, but maybe you do, I don't know. But yeah, so it probably doesn't matter, but it's still not really helpful. Like, let's say someone's riding their bike for weight loss. So they think, okay, I'm not going to waste my calories on drinking sports drink and eating gels. I'm going to eat like a huge meal and like drink four beers after and like eat chips and, you know, whatever. That happens for people who don't have a performance mindset. They are more coming from like diet culture, like fitness culture, I guess. I don't know.
Like you ride to eat junk, and that's
right, right. And so they're just thinking about calories, burning calories, and then eating calories later. But then they're like, you know, probably eventually they're like, I don't know, this doesn't feel that great, or now I really want to do better at cycling, but I need to lose weight and I need to get faster, so I need to get serious about it. And so they contact a coach. They, you know, eventually contact someone like me as well, but for nutrition. But yeah, then they're like, oh, so I need to eat like 300 to 400 calories an hour, maybe, you know, or eventually, or work up to that. That seems crazy. But yeah, like, I mean, you know, your training plans, you don't just do, it's rare that you just do like one hard ride and then you sit around for a few days. it's each ride will build upon the next. And if you don't take the easy days easy, or if you don't, you know, if you don't fuel a hard day and have another like longer day, even if it's an endurance day coming up, like why suffer through that?
Mm-hmm. All right. So that brings me to another question. That's kind of, like the higher intensity stuff. So, let's talk about moderate intensity for a second. So like maybe like tempo or sweet spot or threshold type rides, or maybe like a set of openers or something like that, like maybe a moderate group ride. So does the recommendation for carbohydrate intake per hour change a little bit, or is it still just kind of like, you know, get in what's reasonable for you?
Right. So you're burning a little bit more, you're using a little bit more carbohydrate, you know, as the intensity increases. So if you're one of those people that generally for low zone two rides, you're pretty much sticking to 30 grams of carbs per hour, I would definitely bump that up to 60, maybe a little bit more, especially if you're doing, you know, let's say you're doing like sweet spot ride or over unders or something, and then the next day you're doing like 2 hours of tempo. Yeah, I definitely would be taking in no less than 60 grams of carbs an hour, maybe more. Because again, why not? If you can tolerate it, you can fuel that effort, you can recover from it. And then, you know, when you're off the bike come Sunday night, let's say, you know, you've done two big rides, you hit all your numbers, you felt good, your RPE was like where it should be, you slept well, then you can just like fuel your body with really good, healthy food. And, you know, it's like, that's part of it too. Again, like we're not just counting carbs. We like off the bike, you have to make sure that you're getting your nutrient and your energy needs met. And so recovery is not just about restoring glycogen. It's about all those other things that are happening in your body that require energy.
Mm-hmm.
So again, like getting a head start on that recovery is part of it. So the higher your weekly TSS, you know, the more you're training, like the more I would say you need to be taking in per hour as you can tolerate it.
And so what about the very hardest rides? So like VO2 max, maybe like some FRC, like some 1 minute hill rep, something like that. So like, let's say somebody was going to go out and do, you know, 10 by 1 minute all out hills with like 10 minute rests. It's going to be basically impossible to eat without vomiting something up for a lot of people, doing something like that. So, is it better to like front load, or is it better to like get in there with your stomach feeling okay, then you can eat afterwards if you got to ride more after that? So what would your recommendation be there?
Yeah, probably that. So I would say making sure you're starting out hydrated and with full carb stores. So leading up to that ride, whatever you did the day before, you know, make sure that you're okay. If you're doing, like, typically a VO2 ride like that, you know, it's either going to be a pretty small percentage of the ride, or it's just going to be a short ride that you knock out.
Right.
So for that, like, you can just fuel for that ahead of time. Have full glycogen stores. You don't need to worry about, like, the time is another factor, right? So, like, for anything that's super short and intense, time trial, cyclocross, whatever, like you don't need to take anything in during it as long as you're starting out hydrated and, you know, with full glycogen stores. You had a good big carb breakfast before, your liver glycogen's full, your muscle glycogen's full, your blood glucose is good, and, you know, it's not low. So those are the main factors for that. And then I would say, like, if you're doing VO2 intervals at the start of your ride and then you're going to ride for a couple hours, then you can start fueling more after that. So maybe, you know, 60 grams of carbs an hour. If you're one of those people that, again, has a pretty high training load and you're constantly doing 4 to 6 hour rides, then yes, most of your rides are probably going to be 90 grams of carbs or more per hour. But that's not everyone. So again, right. it really just depends on, again, like, what are you eating regularly? Are you meeting your carb needs on a regular basis?
Yeah, that makes sense. Because I had actually written down a very tongue-in-cheek question for you. I'm not going to ask you in seriousness, but now telling you that I was going to ask you as kind of a joke. It was going to be, once you burn more than 400 kilojoules an hour, do you have to eat 100 grams of carbs an hour?
Yeah, so, right. I mean, I think we've covered that.
But the answer is no. And also it depends. So,
yes.
So, okay. Carbohydrate distribution in terms of glucose and fructose and glucose-like carbs and fructose-like carbs that use the same transporters. So just generally glucose, fructose. So like sucrose is 1-to-1 glucose and fructose. They are stuck together, with what is an alpha-1-4 bond or something. Don't quote me on that. It's been a while. But what is the recommendation for glucose, like maltodextrin, just change of glucose, or like, you know, sucrose, like, you know, people can just put sugar in a bottle and use that. So what is the recommendation for the, like, right ratio, and when do you have to start adding some fructose or really thinking about that? Because can you really eat 120 grams of just straight glucose an hour and have it be effective?
No. So when straight glucose was tested, the upper limit of carbohydrate oxidation was like a gram per minute. And so that's how they arrived at that 60 grams of carbs per hour. Mm. So more than that, if you're trying to get 90 grams of carbs an hour, that's when, you know, the recommendation is to take in multiple transportable carbs. So simple carbohydrates that use different transporters to get across the gut lining. So you can actually absorb them and then measure them in the expired gases, so you know that they've been actually oxidized and utilized for energy.
Right.
As far as the ratio, so I think earlier on it was like 2-to-1, and now I think there's been some more research that suggests that a ratio of like 1 to 0.8 is more tolerable for people from a GI standpoint.
Glucose to fructose, right?
Glucose to fructose or maltodextrin to fructose, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so sucrose would count in that, right? In terms of being like 1-to-1?
Yeah, sucrose is 1-to-1, but here's where it gets a little bit more complicated. So if you're going 60 to 90 grams of carbs an hour, yeah, that might be okay for you. However, the osmolality, again, we'll go to that. So the smaller particles, the simple sugars, are more particles in solution to achieve that carbohydrate amount. But if you're using something like maltodextrin or clusterdextrin, it's bigger particles and not as few. So the osmolality can be actually lower with the higher carbohydrate amount. So like Scratch Superfuel, for example, has 150 grams or an osmolality of like 150, I think. Our plasma is 280 to 290. So it's hypotonic, not as concentrated as our blood and plasma.
Right.
So, but it has a lot of carbs. It has 100 grams of carbs, but it's in a ratio of like, I think it is 1 to 0.8, I think, of clusterdextrin to fructose. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to upset your GI, you know, you're not going to draw that extra fluid in to dilute it, basically. So that's kind of the other issue when it comes to, it's not just the ratio of one carb to the other, it's the concentration and like how much are you trying to take in.
Yeah, and this is actually something that I want to do a whole nother podcast on, is like concentration of drinks and using like liquids to fuel. But you know, this is actually something, one of the questions that I got a couple times when I asked on Instagram, you know, we're going to talk about nutrition. What do you want to know about ride fuel? And a lot of the questions were, is solid food better or is liquid carbs better? Or like, do you compromise hydration by doing this, that, and the other thing? And so this is part of the equation, right? Especially in terms of like hydration and gut comfort, right?
Yes, very much so. It's, so gels, I think introducing gels and really sugar, like simple sugar, sucrose-based drinks is where people really start to get messed up. Because one, if both of those are really hypertonic, so like more concentrated than plasma. So again, you've got to wait, your body's got to wait to pull in water from your body that dehydrates you, that slows gastric emptying. You got this stuff just like sitting there waiting to be pushed through your gut lining into your circulation. But in that meantime, you're just not feeling good. So if it's fine to use gels, that's such another misconception that like gels are not good to use. You have to drink the right fluid with it. So you want to drink water to dilute that out.
And it's quite a lot of water. It's like way more than you expect. It's nearly half a bottle, right?
Yeah, it can be. Again, it depends.
whatever works for you, right?
Yeah, it depends on your intensity. It depends on, you know, how hydrated you are. It depends on the heat. But yeah, so it depends on all those other factors too. But so in general, I would say try to find, if you're trying to get calories from your drink, it's totally fine. I hate when people are shamed for drinking sports drinks, but it happens. But yeah, choose something that's hypotonic. So it will empty through and be absorbed into your circulation faster. It facilitates hydration, and it also facilitates nutrient transport across your gut lining. So if you want to use gels, you know, figure out how much. I also would avoid, like, there's so many products now that have like amino acids added and like tons of electrolytes. Like all of that contributes to osmolality. It's not just the carbohydrate type and concentration. So it's all those particles that affect the osmotic pressure.
Yeah.
So simple products, and you know, how do you know what those are? Well, they're not releasing osmolality for most products. Scratch is great because they do, but most drink companies won't give you the osmolality. But it's trial and error. It's figuring out, okay, yeah, I can't use those gels. I don't like using that particular brand or the super salty ones, especially with my drink. You know, it's like, that's all part of the trial and error.
So a lot of it is just, you know, kind of start with the basic recommendations and figure out what works for you, right?
Yeah, and those may change for the conditions too. So making sure that now, as the weather is finally getting warm for people, at least where we are, it's what works for you. And colder weather, you know, you may find that it doesn't work for you as well in the heat. So, okay, try drinking more fluid. Not necessarily more concentrated fluid, but more fluid to hydrate you, like water or something hypotonic.
I always find that like in the winter I can take like just a regular bottle with scratch in it, but in the summer I have to like reduce the amount of scratch I put into a bottle and add extra salt. Like that works for me, but that's something that I had to learn over the course of many years. So and that's not something that works for anybody else. Or, you know, a lot of other people that I've recommended, oh, you should try this. A lot of them come back like, that was terrible. I'm like, all right, then don't do it.
Right. Yeah. And that's completely fine. Again, like that's kind of the problem with nutrition companies and supplement companies giving these recommendations and like sponsored athletes walking around saying, this is the best thing to use. Well, okay, if it actually is what you're using, it may work for you, but it's not going to work for everyone. And I think that's where a lot of the confusion comes in. And, you know, just knowing that you have to like shop around and like buy a bunch of different things and see what works in what conditions. And then once you find it, stick with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing the amount of, you know, I was really like this as a teenager where I would like really look up at somebody and I was like, all right, what is this person eating? What are they wearing? like how much do they sleep at night? Like how much coffee do they drink? I have to do all these things and I will have their powers. Mm-hmm. And you know, I did the same right when I got into cycling, I did the same thing with like Tom Bonin and Johan Museu. And I was like, oh my God, these guys are so fast. I want to be like that. And then I read some of their training sessions and I did that and they did not work for me.
Right. So. Yeah. And that reminds me of your FTP meme too. Like, you know, you're detrained, like, no, this is what my FTP used to be. This is what I'm going to train at. And like, you're just not going to have success, or this is what, you know, you think you can hold. But no, like, you are an individual. And I think part of tapping into your individual performance capabilities is recognizing that and like working with your body and your physiology, and maybe in time, probably, you know, you stick with it long enough, your training age increases, your experience increases, all that machinery has upregulated over time, you know, with all the adaptations from training and nutrition and diet, and all of a sudden you're a different athlete. And patience is always rewarded in cycling, right?
it really is. And that's, you know, I can't tell you the number of people I've consulted with where, you know, that is pretty much the recommendation for, you know, and that's one of the things I tell people, like, if you're going to consult with me, you know, we're not going to write you a training plan because I don't know how things are going to change. And mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what you need, but that's something that has to be figured out. So I try to give people the tools to figure out what works. And I think that's actually what I like so much about you, among many other things, is that, you know, you're always trying to work on like what's best for this person. Like every time I see you interacting with one of my clients, because they've, you know, got working with you for the nutrition, it's always like, okay, try this, try this, try this, try this. It's not like this is what you should do. It's like you give a long list of things to try.
Yeah, because everyone's different. You can try to like push a plan on someone or a recommendation, and I mean, you and I both know that's not going to work.
And, yeah.
And I think, you know, the reason we have success with athletes and have successful athletes and have great relationships with them is because they trust us, because we understand and we listen to them. And it's not, I always draw so many parallels with training and nutrition. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it's not that different. It's all part of the same system. So,
yeah. All right. So, do you want to take some questions from the Instagrams?
Let's do it. Yeah.
All right. So I got a ton. So thank you all for submitting. I will be doing that from now on at Empirical Cycling. By the way, Marita, where can people find you on Instagram? Because you've got a really, really good account with another nutritionist. I love following your stuff there.
Yeah, thank you. So my good friend and colleague, Kelly Pritchett, she's in Washington. We joined forces because we were so frustrated with, like, not just, I mean, just like bad advice out there, and like, you know, people charging a lot of money for like really general recommendations and steering people down the wrong path. So we're like, let's start like a simple endurance athlete focused, evidence-based, easy to understand. Both of us really care about like translational science, like applied science. So that research paper is great, but how do I apply that? So it's called Inside Sports Nutrition on Instagram. I mean, I'm personally on Instagram too, but all I post is like my dogs now and my baby.
Your dogs
are
great. You've got GSPs and that's
so if
I'm
you're
all about
interested
it.
In that, you can follow me. But you're probably more interested in Inside Sports Nutrition. I wish I could post as much as you do. We've talked about doing like weekend AMAs too, but
I'm gonna send them to you. I'm gonna send them to Inside Sports Nutrition. I'm actually going to suggest you do that there, and I will send people way because, you know, because again, like they can ask you all the questions that they asked me. Because what I have to do right now is I have to kind of cull these down to a couple really good ones. And so I think the first one that I got that that I think actually I'll meld a bunch of questions into one. And so sorry if I'm not going to ask somebody answer somebody's specific question, but. Here it is paraphrased is, what do you think would be a good candy for ride fuel? Because I know a lot of people use Haribo, but over a certain amount, I always get a lot of farts with Haribo. So, are there other similar things that are pretty good, or is that like pretty much the good, like cheap gold standard?
You know, it's super common, like Haribo and Swedish Fish. But to be honest, I'm not a candy expert in like the breakdown of glucose versus fructose in those. They're probably all pretty much the same. I think what might be happening is, yes, you're eating a lot of concentrated sugars, and if you're not drinking enough fluids with that,
nope.
Or getting enough sodium, so, you know, try maybe the salted version too, of the gummy bears. That's another thing that also influences transportation of the carbohydrates, you know, through the gut lining. Like, you need the sodium glucose transporter. So you need sodium. So I don't know that, like, the type of candy really makes a difference. I would try drinking a little bit more and making sure you're getting enough sodium.
All right. Okay, so here's one from a professional mountain biker. How the hell do I fit 100 grams of carbs per hour into my pockets for a four-hour ride or race?
So that's a situation where I would use carbs in your drink. I don't know what you're drinking. If you're drinking water or noon or something, try even like regular Scratch. It has some carbs. It's not a ton, so you still have to eat a bunch to get that. But if you try something like Scratch Superfuel, you know, that gives you 100 grams of carbs. Depending on the type of racing you're doing, you could wear a hydration pack. Sometimes, you know, if it works with your bike fit, and for endurance races especially, it can be really convenient. And again, it's kind of like we talked about carb loading before, like the weight penalty, so you can actually get your nutrition and hydration is inconsequential. I mean, it's more important that you're fueled and hydrated throughout a mountain bike race versus, like, you know. Yeah, it's going to be hard to eat that much of just solid food if that's what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Or use gels and drink water and see if that works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as much water as you can, and maybe, like, just pockets full of, 80 grams gels, something like that.
Yeah,
it does kind of get difficult, like, you know. Especially, I know that this particular athlete, there are, a lot of the pro mountain bikers that they're racing with get a lot of support. And sometimes these pro mountain bikers that don't, you know, they can't bring somebody to hang out in a feed zone or, like, ride between different feed zones for these super long, like, marathon races. Like, you know, they're limited to, like, whatever they can carry.
Yeah, it's true. There's some really streamlined hydration packs now. They're not like the big clunky ones that they used to be. So that's something you can consider. You can wear it really close to your body, still stay somewhat aero, you know, whatever that means for mountain biking. And but yeah, like taping gels to your top tube. The chews and bars and stuff, it's just really hard to get enough, especially like in a technical course. And that's another thing. Like, if you can stay on top of your hydration and you have some carbs in there too with a pack, you don't have to worry about finding a safe place to, you know, to take in fuel without crashing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Here's another good one I like. Is there a difference between eating a bar quickly versus nibbling it over an hour? So, like, if you're supposed to get, like, let's say 60 to 80 grams an hour, if you have it all at once versus spreading it out, is there a benefit or a drawback?
So that generally I would think of as like a gastric emptying type of question. So again, like we talked about with fluid, the bigger bolus of fluid, the faster gastric emptying will be. As far as a bar, I mean, again, if you're going pretty low intensity, it probably doesn't matter. If you're really hungry and now's a great time to eat, you know, you're pulled over on the side of the trail or road and you want to eat a bar, it's probably fine. If you're racing, I would take the approach of making sure I'm staying on top of my hydration. That's really what's going to, you know, push gastric emptying, that increase that rate. So every time you have a chance to have a bite of your bar, whether it's a bite every 10 minutes or, you know, just half a bar and then another half later, I would say that's probably better for a race scenario. versus just like a bunch of solid food in your stomach at high intensity at once.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, so here's another one. I'm not going to ask this exact question, but I'll ask something that's going to make a more general point, which is if somebody's going to wake up early in the morning and do a really intense ride, because that's the only time they can train, like you're up at 5 o'clock and you're on the bike at 5:20, what's a good way to fuel for that ride, you know, knowing that it's going to need some carbohydrates?
Yeah, this is a really common one. So the day before, making sure that you fuel during your ride and or like recovered after it, and so you had your carbs after. So basically, my point is you're not coming into this early morning ride with compromised glycogen stores. It's better, rather than eating right when you get up and hopping on the bike 20 minutes later, I would say grab some water, you know, grab some fluid, and then eat right before you get on the bike or as you start warming up. So within 5 minutes of the start, because if you eat 20 minutes before that 5:20 a.m. ride, your blood glucose is going to go up, your insulin's going to go up, and it's still going to be elevated when you hop on the bike, and you may experience what's called rebound hypoglycemia. So your insulin's still high, you know, which you need the insulin at rest to get the glucose out of the bloodstream into the muscle. But then you start pedaling too, and your muscle starts taking up glucose again from the blood through non-insulin dependent mechanisms. So you're now all of a sudden in a hypoglycemic state and you have low blood sugar. So to avoid that, it just doesn't feel good. It doesn't necessarily like impact your performance, but if you've ever just felt like kind of like, ugh, at the beginning of a ride, that could be why. So I would say, you know, get up, drink, do whatever you do to get dressed. As soon as you're about to hop on the bike, either grab a bar or a gel, some sports drink, start pedaling. And depending on the ride, you said it was intense, so I would take in I would take in 30 grams of carbs right when you start, and then I would take in 30 grams of carbs 20 minutes later.
That is fantastic. I think we could probably do an entire hour on just talking about morning rides. But I think that's a great recommendation just in general. All right, so here's one. So when it comes to more natural carbohydrates, you know, like apples or potatoes or stuff like that, versus more processed stuff, what is the overriding thing to think about with that kind of stuff in terms of just whether it's going to be good nutrition? Because I think you had mentioned something about, you know, fiber content would affect this. But also, I'm thinking water content probably affects it to some degree. But also, like, you know, how does it, does this affect the gut's processing? Or is it more just one of those things of, like, you know, the osmolality, once it gets in there, is going to be the biggest thing? And if you can, you know, tolerate the gut comfort, is it all the same?
Yeah. So I think it depends on what carbohydrate amount you're trying to achieve per hour. If you're trying to get 60 to 100 grams of carbs an hour, eating fruit, eating, you know, apples is not going to be the best way to be able to fit all that food in to get the carbs. So that's the first thing I would think about. Also, again, if you're doing an intense workout, blood flow is compromised again to the gut. So you want the easier, I guess, more processed carbs, right? Versus less processed. So I know tons of people love eating potatoes on the bike, which, you know, they taste really good. They're cheap. They're high carb. But again, a potato doesn't have, you think about like for a large potato, you might be getting 28 or 30 grams of carbs. It's not really, from a performance fueling standpoint, it's not enough. And you're just, you can't eat enough. So I would save those carbs for your meals before and after the ride throughout the day. That's a great time to really focus on complex carbs, high nutrient, high fiber carbs to meet all your other nutrient needs. Your gut health needs, you know, everything throughout the day. But again, if performance fueling is your goal, I would do it with bars, drinks, chews, gels, predominantly.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because every time I eat like a potato, I am super full for like 2 hours and then I am starving because it's just, you know, it's like super filling and then it's not enough calories in general. And it's even worse if I add like eggs to it or something. Oh my God, so, so full.
Yeah. But then like, you know, there's some endurance races that at aid stations, they have like salted boiled potatoes and it's the best thing ever. So that's like something that you can look forward to and you can have, but it wouldn't be like the cornerstone of my fueling strategy. So I am all for eating as many fruits and vegetables as you can. But like, I think that's how I would structure your normal daily diet, which again is super important for performance and fueling. But the time and place for those like convenience foods and sports nutrition products is during your training rides.
All right. Okay. So, just a couple more. So how would you, readjust nutrition based on glycemic index, or is this even worth looking at?
Yeah, it's sort of similar to my previous answer. In general, I think a lower glycemic load is better. And I'm not going to just say glycemic index because you can eat a high glycemic index food like rice, but combine it with coconut curry sauce or something, or, you know, chicken. So protein and fat to lower the glycemic load so your blood glucose doesn't go up as fast. Mm-hmm. But, right, so like in the early morning fueling example, 5 minutes before is a good time to have something that is a higher glycemic index. So a banana, a gel, whatever, because it's going to go into your bloodstream faster and contribute to, and then like by then, your muscle starts contracting and starts taking up the glucose. So, you know, you're utilizing it versus eating a high glycemic meal 20 minutes before, spiking, if you could see my fingers are quotes, spiking blood glucose, insulin, and then it tanking as soon as you start, right? So before a ride, I would say lower glycemic index or load. Right before and during the ride, higher glycemic is good.
Okay, cool. All right, so this is just a very general question. So when making your own ride nutrition or looking at the nutrition facts, that like, is there a certain amount of carbohydrates or fats that you would probably try to avoid in terms of like grams per serving or like per like, let's say 20 to 40 grams of carbs, would you try to limit it to like 2 to 4 grams of fat or and protein for that ratio? Or should it be just like zero optimally?
No, that's fine. I mean, I don't really like pay too much attention to that. Mm-hmm. I guess what I would pay attention to more is what are the ingredients of the bar. So versus a nut bar or a nut butter bar, I would pick something that is more predominantly oats and fruit. So, you know, like more carbohydrate based. And yes, like what binds it together might be nut butter, but that's not like a Lara bar, for example.
Right.
Or like a Clif bar is a great example of a higher carbohydrate bar that still has a little bit of fat and protein, which I wouldn't really count that. But then you have some of these lower carb bars that are more like, you know, lots of nuts and seeds and stuff.
Yeah, and like egg whites. Yeah, I've had those. I mean, they're great if you're not working out, but
yes,
I couldn't imagine eating them
place.
In a workout. Yeah.
Right. So that's kind of what I would look at more, like what are the ingredients versus like the specific grams of carbs and fat. Well, I look at the specific grams of carbs, sorry. I don't really pay attention to the fat and protein as much as I would like what are the main ingredients. I was going to say something else about that.
Okay. Well, collect your thoughts and I'll ask you one last question. And I got a couple people asking about this. So, a bunch of people are asking about Martin, M-A-U-R-T-E-N. How do you, is that how you say it? Martin?
Morton.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Basically just, you know, is it actually God's gift to nutrition is pretty much the, what everybody's asking. Is that just marketing stuff?
Yeah. So, I will say that most people I know who have used it like it, But the hydrogel, like, the verdict is still out on it. I will say for a high carbohydrate rate of intake, like, if you're trying to get 120 grams of carbs per hour, the idea is that, like, the carbohydrate is kind of protected, so it's not going to, it's going to go through your GI tract faster because it's protected in this hydrogel. And then, you know, not impact the, be like hyperosmolar and make you dehydrated and all that. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea behind it. I don't think there's any like convincing research that it improves performance necessarily versus a non-hydrogel carb. But there is one paper I can think of where I think it was female cross-country skiers. I don't remember if it was only females or females and males, but they took in 120 grams of carbs an hour, Nordic skiing, you know, high intensity of the hydrogel, and they, their carbohydrate oxidation rates were high. They didn't, they performed well, and they didn't have GI distress, which is kind of like the main takeaway for me is like, okay, can you take it, if you're trying to get in that amount of carbohydrate intake, can you take that in with using Gatorade and gels? If not, can you take it in using Morton? And, you know, you might have a better time tolerating it. At lower intake rates, if you're trying to take in 30 to 60 grams of carbs an hour, I don't think it would really make that much of a difference. I think that the game changer might be, you know, at the higher rates. It might be more tolerable for some people. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Have you seen any more research on that? I haven't been, like, following it because I wasn't blown away by it, but from an anecdotal perspective, most athletes I work with who use it have enjoyed it and liked it.
I actually look at very little nutrition research because I have about 400 papers that I have on my little docket of things to read. And so I'm just never going to get to that area of the literature. And that's why we have experts like you on the podcast so that I can ask all the dumb questions that I've always wondered about. And then you can, then you can tell me what's...
They do a fantastic job with marketing. They sponsor a bunch of really successful athletes. And so I am, you know, I think you always have to be kind of like aware of that. But just knowing, like if I'm thinking about the science behind the hydrogel versus, you know, when you're thinking about osmolality and gastric emptying and all those things we're talking about, it kind of makes sense that it would help at a higher intake rate. Whereas, you know, more particles, other forms of carbs may not be as tolerable. So that, like, it kind of makes sense to me, but I don't see how it would be any more beneficial at a lower intake rate. Mm-hmm. I don't use it. And I, again, I have some people who do and some people who are completely fine using scratch superfuel. So it just depends.
Yeah, pretty much everybody I coach who has those high oxidation rates, they've either found gels that work for them, or they found a combination of like gels and candy or whatever, and scratch super fuel. And that's pretty much the majority of folks. All right, Namrita, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find you?
So, Instagram, I guess, is probably, you know, the easiest way to find me, inside sports nutrition again. I also coach nutrition with, Velocious and Basecamp. So Basecamp is an off-season training program. So I coach nutrition there. And then my colleague Kelly and I are planning on doing a two-part webinar series in June, specifically on evidence-based practical sports nutrition strategies for endurance athletes. So you can find out more about that at Inside Sports Nutrition. And then, if you work with Coley and, you know, are interested in nutrition, then they can reach me through you.
What's your email address if people want to reach directly to you for like a nutrition consult or nutrition coaching?
Yeah, it's namritabrooke@gmail.com.
That's B-R-O-O-K-E.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You kind of glazed over this, but Velocious is the coaching company that Tim Cusick and his wife run. If you have watched any of the WKO5 webinars besides mine, you've probably watched one of Tim's because he's done like 90% of them. And and Tim coaches Amber Neben. And so Tim really knows his stuff, and Tim has assembled a really, really good group of folks. And that was one of the reasons that I reached out to you initially. I was like,
that's
oh,
right.
my God.
Yeah, that's how we connected.
Yeah, I was like, oh, Tim works with her. She must know her stuff. I got to see if she really does. And like, oh, my God, do you ever. So thank you so much for coming on. And I cannot wait to have you back on again. So if any folks want to suggest topics, I have a whole bunch for Nimrita. But if there's anything specific that you want to hear an hour or more on, just shoot me an email and let me know. Yeah, thanks again, Nimrita.
Thank you. It was fun.
All right. So again, Nimrita, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. That was a great time. I had a great time. I hope you all had a great time listening. And of course, if you want to get in touch with her directly, that is, again, NimritaBrooke@gmail.com. And that is the same on Instagram. And she is a nutrition coach. She's a regular cycling coach. She is involved in collegiate cycling. So I want to talk to her about that at some point. And of course, Inside Sports and Nutrition on Instagram. Really, really, really good follow with her colleague, Kelly Pritchett. And of course, me, as usual, you know, Empirical Cycling, and that's on Instagram, and also at gmail.com for emails for coaching inquiries and consultation inquiries and all the usual stuff. And of course, if you want to support the podcast with a donation, thank you all so much. Helps keep the lights on. You can do so at empiricalcycling.com/donate, and we've got links to everybody's everything up in the show notes. And so you can check that out. Of course, empiricalcycling.com up in the podcast episodes. And so I think that's going to be about it for today. And I can't wait for the next one. So thanks again, everybody, for listening. See you next time.